Chapter 15 of Uncle's Dream by Fedor Dostoevsky, translated by Frederick Weishaw. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Greg Giordano. Chapter 15. If fate makes up its mind to visit anyone with misfortune, there is no end to its malice. This fact has often been remarked by thinkers, and, as if the ignominy of last night were not enough, the same malicious destiny had prepared for this family more, yea, and worse, evils to come. By 10 o'clock in the morning, a strange and almost incredible rumor was in full swing all over the town. It was received by society, of course, with full measure of spiteful joy, just as we all love to receive delightfully scandalous stories of anyone about us. "To lose one's sense of shame to such an extent," people said one to another. "To humiliate oneself so, and to neglect the first rules of propriety. To loose the bands of decency altogether, like this, really," etc., etc. But here is what had happened. Early in the morning, something after 6 o'clock, a poor, piteous-looking old woman came hurriedly to the door of Maria Alexandrovna's house, and begged the maid to wake Miss Zina up as quickly as possible, only Miss Zina, and very quietly, so that her mother should not hear of it, if possible. Zina, pale and miserable, ran out to the old woman immediately. The latter fell at Zina's feet, and kissed them, and begged her with tears to come with her at once to see poor Vasya, her son, who had been so bad all night, that she did not think he could live another day. The old woman told Zina that Vasya had sent to beg her to come, and bid him farewell in this his death hour. He conjured her to come by all the blessed angels, and by all their past, otherwise he must die in despair. Zina at once decided to go, in spite of the fact that, by so doing, she would be justifying all the scandal and slanders disseminated about her in former days, as to the intercepted letter, her visits to him, and so on. Without a word to her mother, then, she donned her cloak and started off with the old woman, passing through the whole length of the town, into one of the poorest slums of Mordasov, and stopped at a little low, wretched house, with small, miserable windows, and snow piled round the basement for warmth. In this house, in a tiny room, more than half of which was occupied by an enormous stove, on a wretched bed, and covered with a miserably thin quilt, lay a young man, pale and haggard. His eyes were ablaze with the fire of fever, his hands were dry and thin, and he was breathing with difficulty and very hoarsely. He looked as though he might have been handsome once, but disease had put its finger on his features, and made them dreadful to look upon, and sad withal, as are so many dying, consumptive patients' faces. His old mother, who had fed herself for a year past, with the conviction that her son would recover, now saw at last that Vasya was not to live. She stood over him, bowed down with her grief, tearless, and looked, and could not look enough, and felt, but could not realize, that this dear son of hers must in a few days be buried in the miserable Mordasov churchyard, far down beneath the snow and frozen earth. But Vasya was not looking at her at this moment. His poor suffering face was at rest now, and happy, for he saw before him the dear image which he had thought of, dreamed of, and loved through all the long, sad nights of his illness, for the last year and a half. He realized that she forgave him, and had come, like an angel of God, to tell him of her forgiveness, here, on his deathbed. She pressed his hands, wept over him, stood and smiled over him, looked at him once more with those wonderful eyes of hers, and all the past, the undying, ever-present past, rose up before the mind's eye of the dying man. The spark of life flashed up again in his soul, as though to show, now that it was about to die out for ever on this earth, how hard it was to see so sweet a light fade away. "Zina, Zina," he said, "my Zina, do not weep. Don't grieve, Zina. Don't remind me that I must die. Let me gaze at you, so, and feel that our two souls have come together once more, that you have forgiven me. Let me kiss your dear hands again, as I used, and so let me die without noticing the approach of death." "How thin you have grown, Zina, and how sweetly you are looking at me now, my Zina! Do you remember how you used to laugh in bygone days? Oh, Zina, my angel, I shall not ask you to forgive me. I will not remember anything about that, you know what. For if you do forgive me, I can never forgive myself. All the long, long night, Zina, I have lain here and thought and thought, and I have long since decided that I had better die, Zina, for I am not fit to live." Zina wept, and silently pressed his hands, as though she would stop him talking so. "Why do you cry so?" continued the sick man. "Is it because I am dying? But all the past is long since dead and buried, Zina, my angel. You are wiser than I am. You know I am a bad, wicked man. Surely you cannot love me still. Do you know what it has cost me to realize that I am a bad man? I, who have always prided myself before the world, and what on? Purity of heart, generosity of aim. Yes, Zina, so I did. Well, we read Shakespeare, and in theory I was pure and generous. Yet how did I prove those qualities in practice?" "Oh, don't, don't!" sobbed Zina. "You are not fair to yourself. Don't talk like this. Please don't." "Don't stop me, Zina. You forgave me, my angel. I know you forgave me long ago, but you must have judged me, and you know what sort of man I really am, and that is what tortures me so. I am unworthy of your love, Zina, and you are good and true, not only in theory, but in practice, too. You told your mother you would marry me, and no one else, and you would have kept your word. Do you know, Zina, I never realized before what you would sacrifice in marrying me. I could not even see that you might die of hunger if you did so. All I thought of was that you would be the bride of a great poet in the future, and I could not understand your reasons for wishing to delay our union. So I reproached you, and bullied you, and despised you, and suspected you, and at last I committed the crime of showing your letter. I was not even a scoundrel at that moment. I was simply a worm man. Ah, how you must have despised me! No, it is well that I am dying. It is well that you did not marry me. I should not have understood your sacrifice, and I should have worried you, and perhaps, in time, have learned to hate you, but now it is good. It is best so. My bitter tears can at least cleanse my heart before I die. Ah, Zina, Zina, love me as you did before a little while, just for the last hour of my life. I know I am not worthy of it, but, oh, my angel, my Zina!" Throughout this speech, Zina, sobbing herself, had several times tried to stop the speaker, but he would not listen. He felt that he must unburden his soul by speaking out, and continued to talk, though with difficulty, panting, and with choking and husky utterance. "Oh, if only you had never seen me, and never loved me," said Zina. "You would have lived on now. Ah, why did we ever meet?"
"No, no, darling, don't blame yourself because I am dying. Think of all my self-love, my romanticism. I am to blame for all, myself. Did they ever tell you my story in full? Do you remember, 3 years ago, there was a criminal here sentenced to death? This man heard that a criminal was never executed whilst ill, so he got hold of some wine, mixed tobacco in it, and drank it. The effect was to make him so dreadfully sick, with blood spitting, that his lungs became affected. He was taken to a hospital, and a few weeks after he died of virulent consumption. Well, on that day, you know, after the letter, it struck me that I would do the same. And why do you think I chose consumption? Because I was afraid of any more sudden death? Perhaps. But, oh, Zina, believe me, a romantic nonsense played a great part in it, at all events. I had an idea that it would be striking and grand for me to be lying here, dying of consumption, and you standing and wringing your hands for woe that love should have brought me to this. You should come, I thought, and beg my pardon on your knees, and I should forgive you and die in your arms.
Oh, don't, said Zina. Don't talk of it now, dear. You are not really like that. Think of our happy days together. Think of something else. Not that, not that.
Oh, but it's so bitter to me, darling, and that's why I must speak of it. I haven't seen you for a year and a half, you know, and all that time I've been alone, and I don't think there was one single minute of all that time when I have not thought of you, my angel Zina. And oh, how I long to do something to earn a better opinion from you. Up to these very last days, I have never believed that I should really die. It has not killed me all at once, you know. I have long walked about with my lungs affected. For instance, I have longed to become a great poet suddenly, to publish a poem such as never appeared before on this earth. I intended to pour my whole soul and being into it, so that wherever I was, or wherever you were, I should always be with you, and remind you of myself in my poems. And my greatest longing of all was that you should think it all over and say to yourself at last some day, no, he is not such a wretch as I thought, after all. It was stupid of me, Zina. Stupid, stupid, wasn't it, darling?
No, no, Vasya, no, cried Zina. She fell on his breast and kissed his poor, hot, dry hands.
And oh, how jealous I've been of you all this time, Zina. I think I should have died if I had heard of your wedding. I kept a watch over you, you know. I had a spy there.
He nodded toward his mother. She used to go over and bring me news. You never loved Moskalyakov. Now did you, Zina?
Oh, my darling, will you remember me when I am dead? Oh, I know you will. But years go by, Zina, and hearts grow cold, and yours will cool too, and you'll forget me, Zina.
No, no, never. I shall never marry. You are my first love, and my only, only undying love.
But all things die, Zina, even our memories, and our good and noble feelings die also, and in their place comes reason. No, no, Zina, be happy, and live long. Love another if you can. You cannot love a poor dead man forever. But think of me now and then, if only seldom. Don't think of my faults. Forgive them. For, oh, Zina, there was a good in that sweet love of ours, as well as evil. Oh, golden, golden days never to be recalled. Listen, darling, I've always loved the sunset hour. Remember me at that time, will you? Oh, no, no, Why must I die? Oh, how I should love to live on now! Think of that time! Oh, just think of it! It was all spring then. The sun shone so bright, the flowers were so sweet. Ah, me! And look! Now, look!"
And the poor thin finger pointed to the frozen window-pane. Then he seized Zina's hand and pressed it tight over his eyes, and sighed bitterly, bitterly. His sobs nearly burst his poor suffering breast, and so he continued suffering and talking all the long day. Zina comforted and soothed him as best she could, but she too was full of deadly grief and pain. She told him, she promised him, never to forget, that she would never love again as she loved him, and he believed her and wept, and smiled again, and kissed her hands, and so the day passed. Meanwhile, Maria Alexandrovna had sent some 10 times for Zina, begging her not to ruin her reputation irretrievably. At last, at dusk, she determined to go herself. She was out of her wits with terror and grief. Having called Zina out into the next room, she proceeded to beg and pray her, on her knees, to spare this last dagger at her heart. Zina had come out from the sick room ill. Her head was on fire. She heard, but could not comprehend, what her mother said, and Maria Alexandrovna was obliged to leave the house again in despair, for Zina had determined to sit up all night with Vasya. She never left his bedside, but the poor fellow grew worse and worse. Another day came, but there was no hope that the sick man would see its close. His old mother walked about as though she had lost all control of her actions. Grief had turned her head for the time. She gave her son medicines, but he would none of them. His death agony dragged on and on. He could not speak now, and only hoarse, inarticulate sounds proceeded from his throat. To the very last instant he stared and stared at Zina, and never took his eyes off her. And when their light failed them, he still groped with uncertain fingers for her hand, to press and fondle it in his own. Meanwhile, the short winter day was waning, and when at even the last sunbeam gilded the frozen window-pane of the little room, the soul of the sufferer fled in pursuit of it, out of the emaciated body that had kept it prisoner. The old mother, seeing that there was nothing left here now but the lifeless body of her beloved Vasya, wrung her hands, and with a loud cry flung herself on his dead breast.
"This is your doing, you viper, you cursed snake!" she yelled to Zina in her despair. "It was you who ruined and killed him, you wicked, wretched girl!"
But Zina heard nothing. She stood over the dead body like one bereft of her senses. At last she bent over him, made the sign of the cross, kissed him, and mechanically left the room. Her eyes were ablaze, her head whirled. 2 nights without sleep, combined with her turbulent feelings, were almost too much for her reason. She had a sort of confused consciousness that all her past had just been torn out of her heart, and that a new life was beginning for her, dark and threatening. But she had not gone 10 paces when Mosgliakov suddenly seemed to start up from the earth at her feet. He must have been waiting for her here. "Zinaida Afanasyevna," he began, peering all around him, in what looked like timid haste. It was still pretty light. "Zinaida Afanasyevna, of course I am an ass, or, if you please, perhaps not quite an ass, for I really think I am acting rather generously this time. Excuse my blundering, but I am rather confused, from a variety of causes." Zina glanced at him almost unconsciously, and silently went on her way. There was not much room for two on the narrow pavement, and as Zina did not make way for Paul, the latter was obliged to walk on the road at the side, which he did, never taking his eyes off her face. "Zinaida Afanasyevna," he continued, "I have thought it all over, and if you are agreeable, I am willing to renew my proposal of marriage. I am even ready to forget all that has happened, all the ignominy of the last 2 days, and to forgive it, but on one condition, that while we are still here, our engagement is to remain a strict secret. You will depart from this place as soon as ever you can, and I shall quietly follow you. We will be married secretly, somewhere, so that nobody shall know anything about it, and then we'll be off to St. Petersburg by express post. Don't take more than a small bag, eh? What say you, Zinaida Afanasyevna? Tell me quick, please. I can't stay here. We might be seen together, you know." Zina did not answer a word. She only looked at Mosgliakoff. But it was such a look that he understood all instantly, bowed, and disappeared down the next lane. "Dear me," he said to himself, "what's the meaning of this? The day before yesterday she became so jolly, humble, and blamed herself all around. I've come on the wrong day, evidently." Meanwhile, event followed event in Mordasoff. A very tragical circumstance occurred. The old prince, who moved over to the hotel with Mosgliakoff, fell very ill that same night, dangerously ill. All Mordasoff knew of it in the morning. The doctor never left his side. That evening a consultation of all the local medical talent was held over the old man, the invitations to which were issued in Latin. But in spite of the Latin, and all they could do for him, the poor prince was quite off his head. He raved and asked his doctor to sing him some ballad or other, raved about wigs, and occasionally cried out as though frightened. The Mordasoff doctors decided that the hospitality of the town had given the prince inflammation of the stomach, which had somehow gone to the head. There might be some subordinate moral causes to account for the attack, but at all events, he ought to have died long ago, and so he would certainly die now. In this last conclusion, they were not far wrong, for the poor old prince breathed his last 3 days after at the hotel. This event impressed the Mordasoff folk considerably. No one had expected such a tragical turn of affairs. They went in troops to the hotel to view the poor old body, and there they wagged their heads wisely and ended by passing severe judgment upon the murderers of the unfortunate prince, meaning thereby, of course, Maria Alexandrovna and her daughter. They predicted that this matter would go further. Mosgliakoff was in a dreadful state of perturbation. He did not know what to do with the body. Should he take it back to Donchanov? Or what? Perhaps he would be held responsible for the old man's death, as he had brought him here. He did not like the look of things. The Mordasoff people were less than useless for advice. They were all far too frightened to hazard a word. But suddenly the scene changed. One fine evening a visitor arrived, no less a person than the eminent Prince Shepetilov, a young man of 35, with colonel's epaulettes, a relative of the dead man. His arrival created a great stir among all classes of Mordasoff. It appeared that this gentleman had lately left St. Petersburg, and had called in at Donchanov. Finding no one there, he had followed the prince to Mordasoff, where the news and circumstances of the old man's death fell upon him like a thunderclap. Even the governor felt a little guilty while detailing the story of the prince's death. All Mordasoff felt and looked guilty. This visitor took the matter entirely into his own hands, and Mosgliakoff made himself scarce before the presence of the prince's real nephew, and disappeared, no one knew whither. The body was taken to the monastery, and all the Mordasoff ladies flocked thither to the funeral. It was rumored that Maria Alexandrovna was to be present, and that she was to go on her knees before the coffin, and loudly pray for pardon, and that all this was in conformity with the laws of the country. Of course, this was all nonsense, and Maria Alexandrovna never went near the place. I forgot to state that the latter had carried off Zina to the country house, not deeming it possible to continue to live in the town. She sat and trembled over all the second-hand news she could get a hold of as to events concerning at Mordasoff. The funeral procession passed within half a mile of her country house, so that Maria Alexandrovna could get a good view of the long train of carriages looking black against the white snow roads. But she could not bear the sight, and left the window. Before the week was out, she and her daughter moved to Moscow, taking Afanasy Matveyevich with them, and within a month the country house and town house were both for sale. And so Mordasoff lost his most eminent inhabitant forever. Afanasy Matveyevich was said to be for sale with the country house. A year, 2 years, went by, and Mordasoff had quite forgotten Maria Alexandrovna, or nearly so. Alas, so wags the world. It was said that she had bought another estate, and had moved over to some other provincial capital, where, of course, she had everybody under her thumb, that Zina was not yet married, and that Afanasy Matveyevich. But why repeat all this nonsense? None of it was true. It was but rumor. It is 3 years since I wrote the last words of the above chronicles of Mordasoff, and whoever would have believed that I should have to unfold my manuscript and add another piece of news to my narrative? Well, to business. Let's begin with Paul Maskelyakov. After leaving Mordasoff, he went straight to St. Petersburg, where he very soon obtained the clerkship he had applied for. He then promptly forgot all about Mordasoff and the events enacted there. He enjoyed life, went into society, fell in love, made another offer of marriage, and had to swallow another snub, became disgusted with Petersburg, and joined an expedition to one of the remote quarters of our vast empire. This expedition passed through its perils of land and water, and arrived in due course at the capital of the remote province, which was its destination. There the members were well received by the governor, and a ball was arranged for the entertainment. Maskelyakov was delighted. He donned his best Petersburg uniform, and proceeded to the large ballroom, with the full intention of producing a great and startling effect. His first duty was to make his bow to the governor-general's lady, of whom it was rumored that she was young and very lovely. He advanced then with some little swagger, but was suddenly rooted to the spot with amazement. Before him stood Zina, beautifully dressed, proud and haughty, and sparkling with diamonds. She did not recognize him. Her eyes rested a moment on his face, and then passed on to glance at some other person. Paul immediately departed to a safe and quiet corner, and there buttonholed a young civilian whom he questioned, and from whom he learned certain most interesting facts. He learned that the governor-general had married a very rich and very lovely lady in Moscow 2 years since, and that his wife was certainly very beautiful, but, at the same time, excessively proud and haughty, and danced with none but generals. That the governor's lady had a mother, a lady of rank and fashion who had followed them from Moscow. That this lady was very clever and wise, but that even she was quite under the thumb of her daughter. As for the general, the governor, he doted on his wife. Maskelyakov inquired after our old friend Afanasy, but in their remote province nothing was known of that gentleman. Feeling a little more at home presently, Paul began to walk about the room, and shortly espied Maria Alexandrovna herself. She was wonderfully dressed, and was surrounded by a bevy of ladies who evidently dwelt in the glory of her patronage. She appeared to be exceedingly amiable to them, wonderfully so. Paul plucked up courage and introduced himself. Maria Alexandrovna seemed to give a shudder at first sight of him, but in an instant she was herself again. She was kind enough to recognize Paul, and to ask him all sorts of questions as to his Petersburg experiences and so on. She never said a word about Mordasoff, however. She behaved as though no such place existed. After a minute or so, and having dropped a question as to some Petersburg prince whom Paul had never so much as heard of, she turned to speak to another young gentleman standing by, and in a second or two was entirely oblivious of Mosgliakoff. With a sarcastic smile, my friend passed on into the large hall. Feeling offended, though he knew not why, he decided not to dance, so he leaned his back against one of the pillars, and for a couple of hours did nothing but follow Zina about with his eyes. But alas, all the grace of his figure and attitude, and all the fascinations of his general appearance, were lost upon her. She never looked at him. At last, with legs stiff from standing, tired, hungry, and feeling miserable generally, he went home. Here he tossed about half the night, thinking of the past, and next morning, having the chance of joining a branch party of his expedition, he accepted the opportunity with delight, and left the town at once. The bells tinkled, the horses trotted gaily along, kicking up snowballs as they went. Paul Mosgliakoff fell to thinking, then he fell to snoring, and so he continued until the third station from the start. There he awoke, fresh and jolly, and with the new scenery came newer and healthier and pleasanter thoughts. The End of Uncle's Dream. Recording by Greg Giordano, Newport Richey, Florida. End of Uncle's Dream by Fedor Dostoevsky. Translated by Frederick Weishaw.